was shopping yesterday, so I'm gonna buy what you need for Santa Claus. My baby was shopping yesterday, so I'm gonna buy what you need for Santa Claus. I'm gonna take mine with me, but I'll leave your heart in my dresser drawer. So that starts me to rambling, looking in all of my baby dresser drawer. Wow, that started me to rambling, looking all in my baby dresser drawer, trying to find out what did she bought me for Santa Claus. When I pull out the bottom dresser drawer, the landlady got mad and called the law. When I pull out the bottom dresser drawer, the landlady got mad and called the law. I was just trying to find what did she bought me for Santa Claus.
Folks, time now for the third and final hour of this post-Christmas edition of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. We got a little of the great late Sonny Boy Williamson 2 doing his tune Santa Claus. And I have to tell you, Sonny Boy Williamson 2 is, without a doubt, one of the most incredible harp players ever to live. You just listen to that harmonica and how he plays and does those bends and the vibratos and everything. Is just take it from a harmonica player myself. It is incredible. As we continue on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, you can probably tell yourself, but some of what he's doing is just pretty darn hard. Good to be with you here on News Talk 710 at KNUS, and to be joined once again on the program by Keith Nobles, author of the novel Our Dogs Did Not Bark, a politically incorrect dystopian tale. And for over a decade, he was a contractor to the military intelligence community during the last decade or so of the Cold War in particular. Keith Nobles, who has a fun Sonny Boy Williamson 2 story, actually, quite a story, joins me here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. Keith, my friend, welcome back and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you, Jimmy.
Thanks so much for joining us. So I would be remiss, since I just played a Sonny Boy Williamson 2 bumper, if I didn't ask you to tell this fun story, at least I find it fun, about Sonny Boy Williamson 2.
Well, so the story goes, Sonny Boy Williamson had gone to the UK and to record an album, and he was looking for a band to back him. And the band that signed on to do that turned out to be what we know as the Yardbirds. The Yardbirds had never recorded at that point. So it turns out, sadly, Sonny Boy Williamson 2's last recording and the Yardbirds' first recording. So the Yardbirds' initial guitarist, Eric Clapton, later replaced by Jeff Beck, who was replaced by Jimmy Page as Yardbird guitarist, but Eric Clapton was the original guitarist, pointed out or made some remark about Sonny Boy Williamson being Sonny Boy Williamson 2, and apparently Sonny Boy Williamson 2 was so offended by that remark, he drew a knife on Eric Clapton and threatened him.
So just for folks who don't know why that's a big deal, there was a Sonny Boy Williamson who was around, predated a little bit Sonny Boy Williamson 2, but then Sonny Boy Williamson 2 said, you know, I'm going to start using the name Sonny Boy Williamson, about the same time when the first Sonny Boy Williamson was still going around and performing. And so people got confused that at some point there was an attributed name to him that was, you're Sonny Boy Williamson too, because people got onto the sort of this semi-con. I mean, both of them amazing harmonica players, different styles in how they approached it. But Sonny Boy Williamson 2 took that name of Sonny Boy Williamson, and then people caught on to it and were like, wait a second, you're not the same Sonny Boy. And then he never really liked being 2 because I don't think he liked people catching on to the con.
No, he was quite an interesting individual to do that and then to be offended by doing that.
Yeah, original name Alex or Alec Miller. And he wanted to keep that, but people got onto it. And so it's no wonder that Eric Clapton would say it. And then Sonny Boy Williamson, too, would be like, oh, no, you didn't. Pulling a knife on him. So, oh, I just love those stories. Like Lead Belly, another legendary, in this case, blues guitarist. I mean, tell us why he got the nickname Lead Belly.
Well, quite obvious once you know the story. He was shot in the stomach at one point, and he got the moniker Lead Belly from having bullet lead in his stomach.
He embraced it. Yeah, these old blues guys, man, I got to tell you, it's just absolutely so fun.
They were hardcore.
Yeah. No, so fun, so fun. All right, well, Keith Nobles, I didn't want to have you on to talk about these fun blues stories, but hey, what the heck. So I wanted to talk to you about a couple of different topics. So one, I want to get this one out of the way. So there's a lot of political correctness going on, a lot of sensitivity about terminology and names. I mean, we saw the Washington Redskins change their name to the Washington Football Team because they didn't come up with a new name when they decided to drop the old one, and they still haven't replaced it. I guess they're going to do another season, if I recall correctly, and still be the Washington Football Team, which I'm just like, what the heck, guys? Come on. Get a real name if you're going to do that. But a couple weeks ago, the Cleveland Indians announced that they are no longer starting, I think, at 2021. They're actually giving themselves a little bit of time before they change the name to come up with the new name. But they're going to be dropping Cleveland Indians. Now, you are a Cherokee citizen. We have talked about Cherokee issues before and American Indian issues before. What do you make of this?
I think it's kind of silly. So, Washington Redskins. So, if I think about that name, do I find it offensive? Yeah, I do. But honestly, I rarely would ever think of it. So, I mean, Redskins can definitely be interpreted as a very derogatory term. However, when you get to things like Indians, Warriors, Braves, I don't see any way that could be construed as being derogatory. But we are reaping having planted critical race theory and intersectionality into our population. Critical race theory basically divides everyone up into one of two categories, either oppressor or oppressed. And this is an example of that. With everyone defined as either oppressor or oppressed, Cleveland Indians can obviously not claim to be oppressed. So they are de facto, within that model of social construction, oppressors. Hence, they have to change the name, even though I don't see how, like I said, Indians, Warriors, Braves, any of these names could be possibly construed as derogatory.
Yeah,
I certainly don't view it that way. But within this model we've adopted, that's how society wants to operate.
Wow.
And, you know, the Cleveland baseball team certainly doesn't want to be cast as the oppressor. We see this outside of sports. We see it growing throughout society. Anyone who has started a business and done well for themselves and added value to other people's lives and gained wealth by adding value to other people's lives are also called oppressors now by these same group of people.
Well, Keith, maybe they just figured, well, we play at Progressive Field, so we might as well go all in with the progressive ideology, you know? No, it really is. It's one of those things where, like, okay, I can get the Redskins point. But when we're talking about Indians like this, you call yourself an Indian, a Cherokee Indian. There are people who will say, no, we should do Native Americans because that's politically correct. You call yourself an Indian, heck of a lot of people who are Native Americans consider themselves Indians. It's not an offensive term. You call it yourself that. So why do people get so uptight about that word?
You know, that's a good question, because, and here's what a lot of people really don't understand. Indian is not a race, an ethnicity, or anything like that. Indian is a legal status as designated by the United States federal government that's derived from Article 1 of the Constitution. That's where Indian comes from. Indian is just a legal status. If I say, I'm Keith Nobles, I'm an Indian, what I'm saying is, I have this legal status in the eyes of the federal government. Now, Cherokee is what I am. Indian is a legal status. And people have a difficult time differentiating these two things. Indian is not a race, a culture, an ethnicity. It's simply a legal status as recognized by the federal government. That's all that term means.
So for the name, though, of a team like Cleveland Indians, people don't think, oh, well, it's a team named after the legal status of a group of people that we call Indians from a legal status standpoint. It is sort of a grouping of, to use the other term, Native Americans in that word Indian because it comes from a legal status.
Yeah, but I don't think there's anything inherently offensive about that word. There's nothing derogatory about it. I mean, I'm, you know, kind of happy I'm an Indian.
Yeah, well, you are. You're very proud. You are a Cherokee citizen, and you used to do the American Indian Festival, right? For quite a while.
Yeah, I was the vice president of the Denver American Indian Festival for a number of years.
Right. So, and you should take pride in that. I mean, you should take pride in the heritage and who you are as a person. And so when people shy away and say, oh, Indians is offensive in this way, you also brought up warriors or braves. What about those terms that are assigned to this idea of Indian as an Indian warrior or a brave?
Yeah, again, I find nothing derogatory about those or offensive.
But why do people do? I mean, why do people feel that way?
Well, because we're back to the whole critical race theory and intersectionality thing. Mm-hmm. We're back to you're either an oppressor or the oppressed. And since the Atlanta Braves or the Golden State Warriors or the Cleveland Indians cannot possibly claim to be oppressed, they are de facto, by default, oppressors. Hence, they must comply with what the adherents of critical race theory think they should adhere to, which may be different tomorrow or a year from now than what it is today. I mean, it's all there's nothing about this objective. There's nothing about this based in truth or reality. It's simply artificial constructs used to control other people and used to obtain things that you otherwise would not be entitled to.
So let me bring this up because this comes to my mind. When I was a kid living in New Jersey, Warren County, New Jersey, I lived in a small town called called Stuartsville. And outside, pretty close to Phillipsburg, New Jersey. And when I played flag football and then I did 1 year of tackle football, the team that I was on was called the Powhatcong Warriors. Now, that team, and I just Googled it and came up with the Wikipedia page here, but that was for Powhatcong Township in the same county, Warren County. It makes sense why I would end up on that team. But the town's name, the township's name comes from the Lenape Indians who called the area Split Hills Stream Outlet, which I assume has some tie into or maybe is the definition for Powhatcong. But I would think going back and looking at Powhatcong Warriors as the team, there's some sort of synergy there in the sense that, like, there's a reason why they might use that word when you're in the town of Powhatcong. I don't know. Is that related? I mean, what do you think?
Again, Jimmy, I mean, I don't find anything inherently derogatory or offensive about that. I just don't. When I was a child, I lived in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is littered with towns that are the origin of the name of the town is Cherokee or Muscogee or any number of other Indian nations. And very often, they named the town after, or originally the town was created and settled by members of those Indian nations. And you end up with, you know, inevitably the high school team being called the Braves or the Warriors or whatever it may be. My father and my mother attended Northeastern State University. Now it's Northeastern State University. It used to be Northeastern State Teachers College back in the day in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which originally, before the state of Oklahoma took it away from us, it was the Cherokee Seminary. It was a Cherokee college and became an Oklahoma State College. And, of course, when my parents went there, they were known as the Warriors. It kind of flowed in that sense.
Yes. Yeah, there seems to be it's almost like there's an intentional, let's sort of, I don't know if paying honor to, showing honor, but to respect. Like, it's a term of respect in using some of these team names when they're in that, like, nobody means anything bad by it. They think that they're doing something respectful.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, Indians, Braves, Warriors, those kinds of things. I mean, other terms are less respectful. Redskins would be an example. Squaw. A lot of people think squaw is an Indian word. It's not. It was a word other people used to refer to women of these various nations in a derogatory manner. So, you know, you can see why squaw is offensive, derogatory. But Indians, Warriors, Braves? No, absolutely, I did not see that. This is simply extending out that whole oppressor versus oppressed motif to make people comply with what you want them to comply with. It has nothing to do with, I mean, honestly, Jimmy, and I've talked about this before, some of these tribal lands are in terrible shape. And people have little to no opportunity, and mostly that's because of interference of government and government control over their lives. And you have tribal lands where people are living in shipping containers and living in cars, and people cannot get jobs, and people are assigned living conditions and assigned housing. That's horrible housing, horrible living conditions. And their only choice is to leave, and many do leave. And this is a real problem. But Indians as the name of a baseball team is not a real problem. How people live, living in poverty, living hopelessly in many cases because they're so suppressed by the government in their ability to pursue opportunities, that's a real problem.
You just hit on something that comes to my mind here, Keith Nobles, and that I've thought about, which is a lot of times it seems like these social justice warrior issues like this one, I think that falls into that sort of category. These are a distraction from the real issues, that they don't want to address those issues in part.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not they don't want to, they can't. I mean, I'll go back.
Okay, they don't want to because they can't. They don't want to talk about them because they can't, but please continue.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go back, and you've heard me say it many times. Victor Davis Hanson said several years ago, the postmodern world cannot solve a problem we're solving. So we put all this effort into renaming sports teams, and no effort into housing people, no effort into being able to expand their abilities to pursue their own opportunities, pursue their own dreams, their ability to house themselves, their ability to feed themselves. They have no answers for those problems other than more of what the government's been doing for decades that's created the problem. And it really is true. The postmodern world cannot solve a problem we're solving. If you really want to solve a problem, we need opportunities for these people living on tribal land, not the government to suppress those opportunities or eliminate those opportunities for them.
So since we're on this topic, Keith Nobles, again, we're talking with Keith Nobles, who is a Cherokee Indian, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and also author of Our Dogs Did Not Bark, a politically incorrect dystopian tale, a novel. Why are so many outspoken or prominent or known Indians left-wing then, like and unwilling to address these issues?
So I don't know that that's true. I think that that is the illusion that the media gives you because those are the people who get on TV and those people who get quoted in these articles.
Very fair.
So most people who have the legal status of Indian do not share these opinions. I'm highly confident in that. Most people who are Indians are like everyone else. You know what they want to have? They want to pursue their own dreams. They want to take care of their families. They want to feel safe and secure financially. There's really no difference there in what people want. And so it's true that the media portrays it otherwise, but that's just simply not what reality is.
Mm-hmm. Fair. I appreciate you noting that, Keith. But also, when it comes to the issues going on at tribal lands, one of the things that you've underscored with me before, and that really fit fundamentally with the nature of how our government is supposed to operate, is that you want to see a reaffirmation of property rights. Talk to me about that for a moment.
A reaffirmation of property rights, a reaffirmation of the treaty rights. And I could go into this some length that we don't have time to do, but FDR, the New Dealers, passed legislation in the 1930s that forced nearly all of the Indian nations to reorganize themselves with the Bureau of Indian Affairs as their board of directors and gave the federal government near total power over the lives of these people. If you can start a business or not on most of these tribal lands, you require the permission of the federal government. Anybody who starts a business knows you start a business because you see a market opportunity. And if you ask, you have to ask permission to the federal government and wait sometimes years for the federal government to come back and tell you if you can start a business or not. Your market opportunity is gone.
Wow.
So these people are working economically. They're working, generally speaking, on tribal lands under severe handicaps that the rest of Americans don't have and generally don't appreciate.
Hmm.
It's not so simple as I want to buy a piece of land and build a house. I need the federal government permission to do that. I want to start a business. I need federal government permission to do that. It's extraordinarily restrictive.
I find it incomprehensible to me because that's like what we see in communist and socialist countries where you have to get the government's permission to do just about anything when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, well, it's the New Deal, right? It's what FDR came up with.
Yes.
It's exactly what it is. You know, we know better. It's the federal government can direct your lives in a manner that is superior to what you can yourself direct your life. That is the presumption of it. That is a false presumption. And in the poverty we see, the shortened lifespan, the social problems, very much root to the fact that the federal government wants to centrally plan what happens on these tribal lands in many cases. And there's a vast difference in, say, the Cherokee Nation, northeastern Oklahoma, which is prosperous, just as prosperous as the rest of Oklahoma is. People can start businesses, build houses, et cetera, without asking permission, as opposed to other tribal lands where the federal government exerts extraordinary control. And it's a stark difference there in lifespan, health, mental health, economic fortunes, being able to pursue your own dreams or having to ask the federal government for permission to pursue your own dreams.
Here's a quote from FDR that I've liked to say over the years. As new conditions and problems arise beyond the power of men and women to meet as individuals, it becomes the duty of the government itself to find new remedies with which to meet them. Government has the definite duty to use all its power and resources to meet new social problems with new social controls. That is a president often hailed as one of the greatest presidents of all time. He's a lot more complicated than people simplify, but we got to run to a break. Keith, I wasn't planning to have you longer, but hey, we got more time. I got a few more minutes on the other side of this break. So I do want to ask you, as a former military intel guy, your thoughts on Russia and China and how they're now doing joint air patrols over the Pacific. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. More with Keith Nobles on the other side here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show.
Christmas. Just like the ones I used to know.
Sunny Santa. No, 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 that just won't do. J.D. McPherson with the fun. A little Christmas tune called Hey Skinny Santa from his album Socks. Check it out. It's a fun one. Good to be back with you. Final segment here on this edition of the Jimmy Sengenberger's Show, the day after Christmas. Great to be with you here on News Talk 710 KNUS, and to be joined a little longer by Keith Nobles, who is a man that I've gotten to know over the years from a lot of different areas. You got a lot of thoughts, Keith, and a lot of insights on a range of topics. And one that you know so well is military intelligence stuff, because you were a contractor to the military intelligence community for over a decade, including during the last decade or so of the Cold War. And I find this topic, I wanted to get your thoughts on, to be particularly notable for conversation, because you have been saying for years now that the United States has been in a Cold War with China since about 1996 or so, since the mid to late 90s. And you've also been identifying a lot of the reasons for why you've seen that coming to fruition over the years. And with that in mind, you also were a contractor of the military intel community during the Cold War, and that was against Russia's former identity as the USSR. And now we're seeing Russian and Chinese bombers. I'm reading from the Washington Times earlier this week. They flew a joint patrol mission over the Western Pacific on Tuesday in what is considered a show of close military cooperation between Moscow and Beijing. That's a long-winded intro, Keith, but please, what's going on here from your view?
Well, China has been upping the ante here for quite some time, and it's odd, to say the least, that in my life, especially in the last year, the United States media certainly has paid less attention to foreign affairs than any time I can recall in my life. And so, well, we're caught up in the COVID stuff, and we're caught up in the election stuff, and now we're caught up in this post-election stuff. We've really not paid much attention nationally, the 330 or so million Americans, to what's going on other places. And China has, over the summer, become increasingly aggressive in regard to Taiwan and in regard to harassing the United States Navy in the Western Pacific. And it must be noted, as we found out here just recently, Russia launched a serious cyber attack against the United States federal government, everything from the Department of Treasury to the government organizations that control nuclear weapons. And we still don't know what they got and how extensive that was, but we know it was pretty bad. There's a lot going on here that the American public isn't much paying attention to, and they probably should. Well, what is Russia and China's ultimate goal here? Well, that's a good question. We don't really know. And we hope it's not ultimately war, but it could be. And, you know, what is more, the other thing many Americans aren't necessarily very aware of, technological changes, advancements in technology like hypersonic weapons are very close to changing the entire dynamic balance of power and paradigm here.
Well, and that's the
Russia
thing.
China and the United States.
Right. Well, we know that China has its sights on being the dominant global superpower. We know that
well,
that's
certainly
the case.
Certainly the dominant power in Asia and the Western Pacific.
Right, but it
and
seems like they want to be the dominant power on the globe, too, though.
Yeah, well, of course they would. But right now, the problem China has is the United States Navy in the Western Pacific. That's their immediate problem.
And the Pacific is where these bombers did their mission.
Yes, yes. And war is changing. It's changing quickly. What the next war will look like, you know, it's the old adage, generals always plan for the last war. Mm-hmm. Well, the next war is going to be very different than we saw in World War II. It's going to be very, very different. It will be very technology focused. It will be cyber war. It will be hypersonic missiles. it will be all these sorts of things. And this is why this is alarming. China and Russia are taking very advanced steps against the United States.
That's what it is. That they are trying to send a message to the United States and to the world about what?
I think the message they're trying to send is we're not as strong as the American people think we are. And they're trying to take a stance of just how much they could damage us in the war. And I have no doubt they could severely damage us in the war, especially as far as cyber war goes. People really need to think this through because there was an incident probably 7 or 8 years ago where somebody, you're probably familiar with the term Internet of Things.
Yes.
And we live now in a world of Internet of Things. People have their lamps and their security cameras and their refrigerators and a number of things connected to the Internet. 7 or 8 years ago, there was a major attack that really hampered the Internet for a few hours where somebody had taken tens of thousands of these various Internet of Things things and turned them around to do a denial of service attack on the Internet. And if you look at what China or Russia probably are capable of doing in terms of cyber warfare, is exactly that. And we're so dependent on that now. People need to appreciate that. What it would be like to be able to go to the gas station and not be able to get gas because that gas pump's connected to the Internet.
Right.
There's a lot of things they could do to make it very unpleasant for us in case of a war.
So Joe Biden, who will be sworn in as president January 20th, he has said that he will retaliate in kind, whatever that means, against the Russians for this cyber attack. He's also indicated that he wants closer and better ties with the Chinese government. So where do you see Biden potentially taking things with these two countries, and what should he do? Because I'm guessing that they're not going to be simpatico.
I'll tell you, Jimmy, I'm baffled by what Biden and the Biden administration said, and I think it's completely unclear what approach they're going to take toward China. You're right. They said they want closer ties. What am I presuming? They're going back to the model pre-Trump of trying to be cozy with China. Hey, don't cause us heartache, and we'll be nice to you kind of model. But I don't think China is so interested in that model anymore. I think they would want something in addition to what Obama gave them. And I don't know that Biden can go there. I certainly don't think he can go there and get reelected. I think one of the better things that happened during the Trump years was a growing awareness of the threat China actually poses to us. As far as Russia goes, Russia has some strategic pieces they can rattle. Cyber warfare, obviously they have nuclear weapons. But as far as an actual military threat, Russia's probably not a really significant military threat in any conventional terms. China could be. China definitely poses a threat to the United States Navy in the Western Pacific with the technical advances they've made in regard to missiles. So what will Biden do about that? Honestly, it's completely unclear.
But what we increasingly are realizing, Keith Nobles, again, military and former military intelligence contractor, what we're realizing is that these two countries have recognized a need to come together and work together in a unified front in various things, like some things as simple as a joint patrol mission over the Western Pacific, because they recognize that they have common interests, particularly in challenging the United States. And that's increasingly clear, and that's something that a Biden administration absolutely needs to be cognizant of, and it's hard to think that he's not, or at least on some level, aware of that.
Yes, he is. Well, okay, let's not overstate that. It's unclear what Biden.
It's hard to think he's not aware of that. It's hard. That's why I framed it this way. It's hard to think he's not aware of that.
Let's assume people in his administration are aware of that. That's probably a better way to phrase it.
Fair enough.
So what Russia really wants is a resurrection of the Soviet Tsarist Empire. They want Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan. They would like to regain all of that territory that they lost when the Soviet Union broke up. The United States stands in the way of that happening. China wants to be, at least immediately, the dominant power in Asia. And the United States stands in the way of that happening as well. China so far has not been able to recapture Taiwan. Sadly, they have essentially recaptured Hong Kong. And the United States did not do a great deal about that, which is very sad. I mean, what Russia and China really have in common is the United States blocks their territorial ambitions. Blocks, especially for China, the ambition to be the dominant power in Asia. And no doubt, they would like to eventually be the dominant power on the planet. They're a long ways from being that. But they definitely want to be the dominant power in Asia and the Western Pacific in the short term. And we stand in the way of that happening.
Yeah. Well, Keith Noble's final question for you, my friend, I appreciate the extra time. What should we be paying attention to in the coming weeks, months, maybe even years when it comes to the way in which Russia and China are partnering up, the way in which they're cooperating, the way in which they act vis-a-vis the United States and the Western world?
Well, more of what we've seen. More aggressive behavior in the Western Pacific, more aggressive behavior toward Taiwan. China has had military aircraft overflying Taiwan this summer, things like that. You would expect we may see more of that. We may see more cyber attacks. I mean, this is a more precarious situation than most Americans believe in. And as I said, certainly 2020, I can't recall a time where we were less informed about what's going on in the world, especially with people who are aggressive toward the United States, than we have been this year.
I think that's a critical point about what's going on this year and how we've been distracted from so many other things going on in the world. Keith Nobles, again, former military intelligence contractor, Cherokee Indian citizen, and also author of the novel Our Dogs Did Not Bark, a politically incorrect dystopian tale. Once again, Merry Christmas, my friend, and thanks so much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you for having me on.
Atmosphere, keeping the spirit alive. Sugar bells out on the shopping street, making sure the kids are alright. Could it be a major movie's coming in? The heavens above us, a big plate, my mama's cooking bread, feeling of love. Everyone can see from the toys and the shoes. Santa Claus getting closer and closer. Heard some talk on the news. Baby, it's time to take your load off. Come in, take your coat off and chill up. Settle down, your family and friends are here. Can't explain how it feels.
Day after Christmas edition of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. But hey, I'm still feeling the Christmas spirit, so why not play some more of the best Christmas bumper music known to man? I really enjoy this tune. Another Eric Clapton Christmas song from his album Happy Xmas that I think came out in 2018. Definitely worth checking out. My thanks again to Keith Nobles for joining us on the program. And let me just address one thing, because I'm sure there are some of you who are listening who are like, Jimmy, why? Why did you say Joe Biden will be sworn in as president on January 20th? And I'll tell you why. Because he will. Mike Pence is not going to stop the process of the electoral votes being counted. There may be a handful of congressmen or senators who will try to put a stop to it. That's not going to end it. I'm just being realistic. I'm not the kind of person here on this program or any other venue that I speak on, write in, whatever. I'm not the kind of person who's going to be disingenuous to you or who is going to mislead you or who is not going to be realistic with you. I'm not going to put my head in the sand and ignore reality. I understand that there is angst, that there is anguish, that there is frustration, and yes, with good reason. Absolutely with good reason. But we are where we are, and I'm focusing now on what we are going to be enduring the next 4 years and on the fight that is yet to come over foreign policy, the fight that is yet to come over health care, the fight that is yet to come over taxes in the economy, the fight that is here regarding COVID but will only amplify even more, ramp up even more with Biden wanting to advance left-wing policies with regards to COVID-19 restrictions on our daily lives. On this program, I want to talk about the issues that matter and how we can address those issues and how we can fight the good fight for the betterment of our country. All is not lost. It may feel like it in many respects, but all is not lost. Christmas is about hope. 2021, I feel, in many ways is going to be better for so many people. Myself included. I'm ready for the end of 2020, that's for sure. But there's a lot to be hopeful for and to look forward to. And there's a lot of reason, there's a lot of justification behind staying in the fight and keeping at it, not giving up. But in order to do that, we have to recognize where things are at and where they are headed. And as we go into 2021 next weekend, here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, that's what we're going to do. We're going to stay in the fight. We're going to fight the good fight and make sure that every person listening to this program understands what is going on and how we can combat it. That you really recognize what the Biden administration is doing and will do, because we're not there yet, thankfully, so that you can educate others and push back and try to right the ship, because there's a hell of a lot of bad that Joe Biden's going to do as president. And we need to be ready for it and to have meaningful discussions about the issues of the day. So on this, my last moment of commentary here on KNUS before the end of 2020, let me just say, let me entreat you to please not give up and to please acknowledge that we have to talk about things as they are, not as we want them to be. The left is marked by idealism, by the idea that we can manipulate society in this way and that way. We don't have to look at things as they are. We can just shape them into what we want them to be. And they use government to do that. That is one of the fundamental differences between conservatives and liberals, between the right and the left. And that is that we look at reality, we see it, and we work within its confines. And we don't get some sort of mythos going in our mind about how we can mold morality and mold society and mold the economy in ways that we would like to see it. And I think that's an important distinction and a valuable distinction. And that's one that we will continue to make here on this program. We will approach things as they are, not as we want them to be, and we will stay in the fight for basic principles, for first principles, because we cannot throw up our hands and give up. And we must educate others and engage. I'm looking forward to that in 2021. I appreciate you being along for the ride here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, Saturday nights, 5 to 8 p.m., News Talk 710 KNUS. It's been quite a year in so many ways, and I thank you for your participation, your listenership, and also for following my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads, which is now available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Just search Jimmy at the Crossroads podcast. I hope you had a wonderful Christmas. Next Saturday night, we will be live in studio with none other than Biff Gore. We're going to have some great conversation. We're going to play some music. It's going to be an absolute jam session in all ways of saying the word jam. It's going to be an absolutely fun time. And I hope you will tune in then. We've got a lot of fun things in store with Biff Gore and more coming up next Saturday night here on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. For now, Happy New Year, Merry Christmas once more, and we'll see you in 2020. As always, may God bless America.
Say hello to friends you know and everyone you meet. Ho, ho, the mistletoe hung where you can see. Somebody waits for you, kiss her once for me. Have a holly jolly Christmas, and in case you didn't hear, oh by golly, have a holly jolly Christmas.